This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers produce over 600 varieties, types, and styles of cheese. That's twice as much as any other state. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
This week on Meat and Three, it's our season 4 finale, and we're sharing some of our greatest kitchen joys.
Maybe most people consider making it too much work or too messy, but this is the food that's worth the work and worth the wait.
You always know where the thing is because you put it away the right way the first time.
You just sort of stand there, and you know, with your hand on your hip and one leg outstretched, glass of wine in your hand, staring into the refrigerator going, okay, speak to me.
Oh yeah, what are you doing with the celery tonight?
I'm making a simple syrup for a gin cocktail with the celery. And I also found a recipe for a celery soup that's going to use up the celery and the potatoes and some of that dill that we still have hanging out in there.
Tune in and be inspired to find the joy in your kitchen. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat in Three wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guests are Sarah Thomas, Marie Poncinet, and Katja Scharnagel. We'll talk to Sarah, Marie, and Katja about wine, women and wine, La Bernardine, their projects, and more. We'll taste the Colette Merlot for our weekly wine sip. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Sarah Thomas, Marie Poncinet, and Katja Scharnagel are all sommeliers at one of the most revered restaurants in the world, La Bernardine in New York City. Under the tutelage of Aldo Sohm, they provide deep skill, knowledge, and personality to the La Bernardine wine program. Katja is the chef sommelier. Sarah Thomas has also created Kalamata's Kitchen, and Marie Poncinet just released a very personal wine, a Merlot. We will discuss everything with everyone. All right, we're going to be speaking with Katja, Sarah, and Marie individually. We'll start with Katja Scharnagel. Katja, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. I've been graced by your services before, so it's nice to sit down with you casually and talk. I want our listeners to get an idea of who you are and where you came from. So give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to where you are today, which is the chef sommelier at La Bernardine. Not bad.
Not bad.
Don't take too long.
Okay, I was born and raised in Austria in the Wachau, beautiful wine region. Grew up at a winery and kind of was surrounded by wine all my life. Initially, I didn't want to become, end up a sommelier or in a restaurant business. I wanted to become a kindergarten teacher, but I cannot sing and I cannot play an instrument. So okay. Kind of like, they were like, nope, this is not going to work for you. And I'm like, okay. What else? So I went to culinary school, graduated, worked in great restaurants, and then I visited New York years back for 2 days and fell in love with the city, and I'm like, maybe I can work here.
What year was that New York visit? Do you remember?
2009.
Okay, so 10 years ago.
10 years ago, yeah.
Okay.
And I started, you know, I was back in the hotel in Austria and was talking to a regular, and he's like, oh, you ever heard about Aldo Sohm? And I'm like, I've heard about it, but I don't know him. And then he called him. I was like, oh, I have a girl here. She wants to come to New York. So I set up a phone interview with Aldo. And the first thing he's like, you know, listen, this is not Sex and the City. I'm like, okay, I guess. I
or
can
Housewives
work.
Or Housewives of New York, like, you know?
Yeah. So I visited New York and had a couple of meetings with him. And he was like, you know, if you want to work here, you know, I can help you.
So do you think the Austrian thing had anything to do with it?
I don't know if it was the Austrian thing.
But you had worked in Austria,
yes,
in hospitality,
yeah, yeah,
at
yeah,
a couple of fine,
yeah,
places.
Yeah, yeah,
what,
yeah,
were some of the places you worked at?
I was the maitre d' and wine director for a Michelin star restaurant up,
right,
in a mountainous area, in a ski area. And Aldo grew up not far away from there, and we had kind of like the same mentor.
Right.
And he recommended me, and he was like, you know,
So you came from a good line of people.
Yeah.
So you talked to Aldo, and pretty quickly after, he says, come and do this with us?
Not quite sure, because he was like, you know, if you want to work in New York, I can help you to like set up an interview at different restaurants. But I was like, no, I want to work here.
Okay.
And it took me like a year and a half to kind of make it happen.
What were like, you doing in that year and a half?
I was back in Vienna. I was
at a
project, yeah.
Okay.
For a hotel opening, and then they decided not to open it, and we all got fired. And I was like, oh, cool, I can go to New York.
So you started here, was it about 9 years ago?
I started in 2011, November 2011. Yes.
Right, so you're going on 8-9 years.
Oh, yes.
So tell me, did growing up in Austria have any effect or influence on your love of wine, and how has it affected wines you drink today? I mean, were you just cloistered to those wines of the region and you discovered here? How did that open up?
I think I started to learn really about wine when I started here, because New York is such a fascinating city. You can taste so many things here, you know, it really opens up your mind. In Austria, we love our wines, you know, and growing up in a wine region, that's the only thing pretty much you drink, and you know, we're very loyal to.
But curiosity, yeah. I mean, were there Bordeaux around and Burgundies?
Not Burgundy, but Bordeaux and like Italian, Super Tuscans for red. But for white, it was just pretty much
Austrian wine. Get here, and like, everything is here.
Exploded. Like, you know,
What was your reaction when you saw the wine cellar?
I was pretty intimidated. Like, you know, at the beginning, like when you start selling the first Burgundies, you're like, oh my God, you know,
I get to
open those wines, you know, and taste it. So
we'll talk about that in a minute. You are an advanced sommelier, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you have aspirations to become a master sommelier?
Yes.
Are you currently...
We just all went for the theory, so...
Okay.
It wasn't that successful, but, you know,
so
it's the first try.
Tell me two things. The easy question first. What's the timeline? I mean, as far as accomplishing that, if everything goes well, what are we looking at? A year, 2 years, three?
It's hard to say.
Minimum of a few years?
Yes. So everyone wants to try it, like, in a certain amount of years. But it's a journey. You keep on learning. You keep on tasting.
Right.
You
so
know,
everything
then, like,
you absorb along the way is important.
There's not like you say, okay, I want to have this done in 2 years. I think that's impossible to say.
Why is it important to you to have an MS after your name?
I think it's more like an ego thing, just to, I have it accomplished, I can do this.
Right.
So I feel that's for me. But also like moving on to like, you know, maybe moving into teaching or, you know, other projects, you know, as much as I love the restaurant, the floor, but you know, maybe, you know, you want to start a family, you want to have kids, you know.
Right.
It's very tough with working schedule in a restaurant.
So. I have a guest coming on in October, Jane Lopes, and she accomplished her MS, and there was a mini scandal and they pulled it from her, and she decided, you know what, I'm not going to go for it. A little different, you know, than everyone else. She's a little frustrated and mad, but I understand how important it is, and I understand the process, you know, kind of, like I said, feeds your knowledge and passion.
And I think that's the most important thing, and that's how you look at it, just to keep on studying, learning, and, you know, have the knowledge and show it to your guests and be better at
when
your job.
I think you said Burgundy, but when you got to New York and you walk into a cellar like this, is that the wine or wines that you wanted to taste most, know more about, was a Burgundy?
Yeah, but also American wines, you know, it's like, you know.
Really?
In Austria, we get... Like nothing
like what,
like
Cali cabs?
Yeah, like old Diamond Creeks or like old, like, you know, that's like, there's some great history behind it, you know, when you look at it, you know. And it's the first time you taste them, you're like, wow, that's incredible.
I'm surprised that, you know, you said that, but that's nice. All right, I'm very interested, because this is sort of a hallowed institution, Le Bernardin. I'm very interested, and walk me through a busy day, but what's a typical day in the life of the chef sommelier at a Le Bernardin? I mean, how long? What are you doing? I mean, we know you're opening wine and serving it, but there's a lot behind that curtain.
It's like the tasting appointments in the morning.
With who?
With vendors, or, you know, or we go to office tasting. Usually Aldo and I do the tastings all together.
Are you doing that every day?
Are you doing that every week,
a few times a week?
We have like periods where we're pretty active, and then you're like during the summertime, not so much, you know. But I also do like all the private events, so it's a lot of emails, you know, they're coming in. So,
do you go out to do portfolio tastings?
If sure, yeah, totally. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
What about inventory?
Oh yeah, totally. Love it.
Isn't that the worst thing?
No, I love it. I love numbers. Yeah, yeah.
Do you have to schlep around boxes of wine?
Absolutely. Part of our job. We're a great team and we all work together. So.
Right.
I still love cellar work, you know.
What's interesting is many, many years ago in New York, there were about 8 sommeliers in the whole city. Now you walk into a Le Bernardin or an 11 Madison, and there's more than a handful. How many people are working with you?
We're currently 8 on the team.
So on any given night, how many people would be on the floor?
4, definitely, and then 1 for private events, you know, so...
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of times private events are happening simultaneous to dinner service and all of that. Yeah. So everyone just fans out on the floor and just starts popping the best bottles and all of that.
And the pairings, and, you know, it's fun. It's great.
So let's talk about that. You said pairings. You have a very extensive wine list. How large is it?
Like 1,000 positions. It's always changing.
A thousand different positions. Yeah, yeah. Way more bottles.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you're always acquiring, selling out, and all of that. Yeah. Are there a lot of verticals?
Not that much.
That's not important.
No.
Right? Yeah.
It's just like we're keeping buying and selling pretty much every day. So we have like a very good rotation of our wine list.
Do you keep, for regular customers, which a place like this has, right? Do you keep in mind that this guy is a 80s Bordeaux lover, so you'll always make sure you'll have what he likes that year around?
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to say no to anybody.
Yeah.
So the list skews heavily French.
Yeah, definitely. It's Burgundy and, you know, white and red, but also a little California.
More Burgundy than Bordeaux?
Yeah, a little bit more Burgundy than Bordeaux.
Okay.
We still have a lot of Bordeaux as well, and... You know, but also Austrian, German wines, Spanish wines.
Well, we know that. So let's talk about that. So a lot of Burgundy, a lot of Bordeaux. What about American? You talked about
all the cabs and all of that. Yeah.
Then after that, there's a good showing of Austrian and German wines. And then after that, where does it go? You said Spain.
Spain, Portugal, a little bit Italian, you know. Okay. We're trying to be like...
Not that much Italian?
Not that much Italian.
Okay.
A little bit Barolos and stuff, but not that much, yeah.
It's funny. I guess because of the type of restaurant and the type of food, Italian is not the most compatible.
I don't know. We didn't kind of like look, to be honest. Like, it's not really our focus, you know, so...
Right. What in your mind is the most interesting wine on the list? What do you walk in the cellar and you look at that and go, oh man. Or type. I mean, what does anything...
There's so many cool things on there. There's like very old legendary wines, but there's also some new fun stuff. We try to keep it as approachable and fun for everybody. So we have stuff for like their Bordeaux lovers that are coming in. But we also want to have a list for young people that are coming in and spend the money that they have at La Bernada, but want to have them serve a bottle that's like $60 or $70, and it's what we stand behind, and we have fun opening for them, you know?
So a lot of people, when they come into a restaurant, and even to the next level, a restaurant, you know, of this status, are intimidated. That's the oldest Somme story. You know, they either think they want to know more than you or they shut down. What advice? Let's talk fine dining. Let's talk the Le Bernardins and all the other 2-3-star restaurants. When somebody walks into a restaurant, how should they approach wine and the wine list? What would you advise them to do?
Just straight out and like ask for the sommeliers, like what excites you, what's new, or like, you know, I mean, and then just be open also with the price point sometimes, you know, people coming in and they feel like they have to spend like X amount,
right?
But they actually kind of like not confident with it, and just be honest about them, tell what you like or you don't like, you know.
So I think the first takeaway on that is you have to talk.
Yeah.
You have
Let us know what you like.
You have to express.
We'll make it happen, you know.
I think two things you pointed out, and I agree with you, are what do you like?
Yeah.
And then I guess the psalm could dig in deep. And price. Yeah. There's nothing worse than bottle shock, right?
Yes.
That bottle shock face, you know, what did I do here?
Yeah.
What about on your end? I mean, do you feel you have to pull out of people a little? You know, what do you like? What types and all of that? Isn't that on you?
Yeah.
I mean, if a customer is kind of quiet or shy, I mean, will you take the time to...
Oh, definitely. You have to, because that's what we're here for. We try to, like, you know, be helpful and also, like, make the best guest experience, you know?
Right.
And, you know, and sometimes people come in and it's like, oh, my God, we don't drink white wine, but I guess we have to because it's a seafood restaurant, you know? And I was like, no, what do you usually drink? What is that excites you, you know? And if it's a bottle of, like, big and bold red, you know, we have this here too, you know? And if this is, makes you happy and this is going to be the best experience, why not, you know? So.
Well, it's funny you
it's
say
not about
that
because
I think...
It's more about the guest. 100%. That makes them happy, you know?
But I think... Probably currently and certainly in the past, you know, there was psalms that are like, oh, you can't drink red with, you know, fish or whatever. But, you know, anything goes.
Absolutely. Oh, my God, yes.
You know, in that sense. Most valuable wine on the list. I had Aldo on the show, and I against my own judgment, I asked him, you know, what's the most expensive bottle or, you know, he said, I'm not going to divulge that, but, you know, in an Aldo kind way and all that. But what's the most interesting, valuable wine? Is it typically Burgundy?
I would say, yeah, dollar amount, yes, definitely Burgundy.
Like Bordeaux. A DRC or a Rousseau?
Yeah.
Are those the most valuable wines in the cellar? I mean, there's nothing...
There's some certain things where you just, like, you know, you, like... You know, you get them once a year in, like, you know, and, like, you know, oh, my God, you know, we just got a case or we've managed to get a case and all the psalms are jumping on it and sell it in within, like, 4 days. And you're like, God damn it, we worked so hard to get this wine in.
It's crazy, right?
And
it's like these revered wines,
okay,
they come in once a year, you get 12
and
bottles.
And it's not like the dollar one, it's just because they're so exciting and good and, like, you know, everybody loves them. Like,
But I would think that a restaurant like this has relationships, and access.
Totally.
Because you have deeper pockets because you turn it around,
you
know, so you get first dibs. So I guess what you're implying is maybe that case you're getting, no one else is getting it or they're getting a bottle.
Yes.
But
what, still, you know.
What happens? I mean, when a case of so-and-so comes in and you know you have customers that like that wine, will you reach out to them? Will you hold it for them? Like, if I'm a regular here and I come in and I drink Rousseau or something and I come in 2 weeks after the wine and you say to me, oh, we got a case and we sold everything out, I would be so upset.
Yes.
So
no, we don't tell them.
You don't.
No.
But
no,
will you reach out to them or it's here
It's here and, you know,
And certain customers, you know, they like that. So you'll say, we just got.
It'll make them like, you know, if they come in for dinner, it's like, oh, listen, we just got this in. It's not going to be long, you know.
Is there still a time where somebody orders a wine, you go downstairs, and it's gone, like for whatever inventory or bookkeeping record?
No, it happens because we're four sommeliers on the floor, you know? So it happens that somebody sells the last bottle, and you literally just
Right, so it's situational that night, that hour, and all of that.
Yeah. That
Anybody ever get really pissed off? No.
No. We're professionals enough, and then we go back and, you know, talk to them, and it's like, maybe I have a second choice, or, you know, so...
How do you monitor your wine? Is it computerized and everything? Is it pretty much manual?
We have like a system, inventory system, and go through. But also, like, you keep on looking on the wine list, and we talk about it. And it's like, okay, so what do you think? Where we need something? But it's more like hands down and just go through or like certain areas. We're like, okay. Came back to the Spanish wines or like, you know, Tenerife, you know, it's a hot area, so we taste a lot of them. And I was like, okay, you know, maybe that could be interesting for, we kind of like have to have moving wine list.
Right.
So certain things will be always on there, but there are fun parts where I can adventure a little bit out and do
How
new
much
things.
Of that type of thing on the wine list is dictated by your guy's desire to bring in newer wines or regions versus customers asking for it? Is this a traditional wine list customer and it's you guys that are introducing it, or are people saying, how come you don't have, you know?
No, I think it's reintroducing
You are.
Yes.
So yeah, it's coming more from you guys in that sense. I would think so. Is there room, like let's say fall is a big tasting month, portfolio tasting, the vendors are in town, winemakers are, you know, the grand tasting and all that stuff. If there's a time where there's a lot of good wine, is there enough room to put wine on, or you have to be careful how much you could add?
Careful, and then, but also like you make like a plan basically, where like you have like, okay, this is what we're gonna bring in the next couple of weeks, and then like, you know, you pause, and then you have like a backup list, like, you know, okay, this is things that we tasted, might not have room for now, but bring it on like in a couple weeks, you know, or if it's really kind of like, okay, we might get just one case, so we buy it and put it on the side, you know, and put it on the wine list a little bit later. But.
Let me ask you this and try to think about it and be honest. Do you feel it's harder to be a woman in the wine world than a man? Do you not notice anything? Do you think working as a woman in the U.S. is different than working in Europe? Are there... Is the business different? Are men different? Is the environment different? Has it ever been an issue with you?
To be honest, no. I never witnessed anything. I never kind of like... I feel like if you work hard and you're interested and you like... You can make things happen, you know? I never kind of like had an experience where like, oh my God, you know? Never, to be honest. It's...
Not even in Europe when you were working?
Not even in Europe, you know?
That's great.
Sorry.
You know, no, there's no apologies. I'm happy for you. And it's just not the wine world. It's the world of business. You know, there's a whole show and discussion, you know, on women in business and the financial world representation. It just happens to be that wine is still male dominated.
Oh, it's definitely. It's still
specifically
like a
here, you have one of the owners who's a strong woman, and you have, you know, Aldo, who obviously is very much committed to his people.
But also, like, here we have so many great women, like, you know, our director of finance, she's a woman, Kathy, she's like, you know, then Karen, so our GM, Katie, like, they're all like pretty good female, strong.
I think
female.
It's an important thing for the culture and the environment here. All right, we do a thing on the Grape List, on the Grape Nation every week called the Wine List. Usually we have one guest a week, but there's not many opportunities when you could sit under one roof, you know, and have the talent, you know, that exists here. So the Wine List, we ask our guests five questions about their preferences. I'm going to break it down and split it amongst you guys. So I'm going to give you two questions, and all the Wine List and the, we're going to try a Colette later. We post everything on social media. Okay. So here's your two questions, okay? Give me your favorite wine and food pairing. And then let's look in the through the lens of Labernardine. Yeah. What do we think is the classic pairing here? Okay. So is there a wine and pairing you grew up, wine and food pairing you grew up with, or later on that you just put it out and you go, oh, wow, this is perfect? And it's not something you'd eat every night or every month. But
There's this great Thai restaurant in Queens where Aldo's favorite place was. And
what's the name of it?
Shripapa.
Okay.
And they have like this crispy, spicy pork on there. And this with an old German Riesling is just to die for it.
So it has to be an aged Riesling?
Can we, like, yeah, it's better with,
but
like,
you said
know,
old right away. Why old versus, you know, a newer vintage? What does that do?
The secondary aroma, like, you know, have like this
okay.
this sweetness, that's, but it's not as
so the nuance
anymore.
And complexity from being in the bottle a little longer.
And it's just like, it's so delicious. Like, you have the spicy pork and like some... We had some great fun out there. So.
That's a good one, and that's that's sort of classic.
Yeah.
I mean, Riesling, Gruner, Gewürztraminer are great with you know, Asian spicy foods and all that. So that's a good one. We'll post that. Now, we're sitting here, and we're thinking about the great food and the great wine. What's a classic Labernardine pairing? And I guess you have to think about this when you do the by the glass and pairing stuff.
I think like right now the chef's tasty minute the pairing is like the Dover sole with the Beurre Blanc and a glass of Krug champagne. I think that's something pretty classic and really good.
It took over 20 minutes for the word champagne to come up, you know, and it's such a perfect wine in life and for a place like this. You know, I think that's fine. I think if somebody stole your aged Riesling at the Thai place and gave you champagne, you wouldn't be much off either, right?
I wouldn't be upset either.
All right, here's the second question. So, and this is tough for you, but you're out and around there and put your retail hat on. Can you suggest a wine retail around $15-$20, a red and a white? And here's what I always tell my listeners. I have three boys, they're in their 20s, they're all working, they're starting to make money, they can't be knuckleheads anymore, they can't show up at parties with crappy wine, when they're serving dinner, they can't. So they can't, they shouldn't buy wine for $8, $12, and they can't afford $40, $50.
Yeah.
But how do you impress, give me a red and a white for $15, $20, and you can give me category, maker, like Muscadet is a category. So what would you recommend?
For white, I would go to Austria, like a nice Grüner.
I think that's so that where you may. You know, so let's talk white.
Like, you know,
Austria?
Austria, yes, definitely.
What kind?
Grüner, like in like Fronau, Petersburg, Wadi. Find great, great wines out there for like $15, $18.
Do you have a producer that comes to mind?
Like Bernadotte, for example. Amberg.
Spell.
Bernard B E.
Oh, Bernadotte?
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
Bernard O T T. Yeah. He has some beautiful wines.
It's great. They're and very like reasonable. You never can miss it.
All right, so that's good for the white.
Yeah.
Suggest a red to me in that price range. Red's always a little tougher.
Yeah, it is. But I would go to Spain, to be honest.
Good call.
Yeah, you get great, great. Up like Monterey, we have one on. Menthia based red, you can find great quality for like you open it and have fun with it.
So from Menthia, any particular makers?
Just put one on the list. It's called Ananda, but
we'll talk off air and I'll put it on our social media. So go with Austria for the white and Spain for the red. Good calls. All right, Katya, I think we covered a lot. I want to thank you for sitting with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Katya is the chef sommelier at Le Bernardin. So when you come in here, look for her with her test of vin and their uniform, but everyone else is walking around like that.
Oh, totally. We have an amazing team
here. But you'll find her. thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Since the mid-1800s, before Wisconsin was even recognized as a state, its resident cheesemakers have been putting the art into artisan cheese. When early settlers from Switzerland, Germany, and Italy came to Wisconsin, they brought their cheesemaking expertise with them. They chose Wisconsin because the terroir reminded them of the homes they'd left behind in Northern Europe. The soil and water of Wisconsin is nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment. And those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin's cheesemakers draw from their rich European heritage and cheesemaking traditions, and combine them with incredible innovation to produce half of the nation's specialty cheese. Wisconsin cheesemakers never stop experimenting, trying to improve, and dreaming of your next favorite cheese that has yet to be imagined. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Sarah Thomas is an advanced sommelier at Le Bernardin and co-founder and chief imaginator at Kalamata's Kitchen. Welcome to the Great Nation, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
There's a lot going on with you. Can you give us a quick background on your journey in life and wine that got you to Le Bernardin and also your more than passion project, Kalamata's Kitchen? And I think you started in Western PA, get me out of there quickly and let's talk about
it. Well, I got out of there pretty quick, too. Okay. I was born and raised in Somerset, Pennsylvania, which is like the middle of nowhere. A small town. I left when I was 16, went to college in Virginia, went to grad school in England, did a master's in Renaissance English literature.
In England?
In England, yeah. University of Cambridge.
Cambridge,
yeah.
Right. Oxford. Yeah.
Sorry, I came to Harvard.
Harvard, yeah.
No.
Shut up. Right?
Yeah. It's fine.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it's like living in Harry Potter world. It was wonderful. I loved
it.
But I the year before that, I had been working in a school for intellectually disabled children in India. When I did my master's,
Why India?
My family's from South India, from right. Kerala. I was born and raised here, but I used to go back to stay with my grandparents every summer.
So you had family to visit?
Yes, my grandparents were there.
So the connection to go back and teach
correct.
Was in the family.
Yes, and they were doctors, and we always had that compulsion to, like, especially work with children.
Right.
That's when I started to think maybe I should. I had started in college as pre-med, and then I switched to literature and politics. And then when I did that, I thought I should go back to medicine.
So you start in pre-med because typical pressure from, yeah. you know, that generation Indian family is yeah. like, this is kind of what I got to do.
A lot of my family members, including my father, are physicians.
Okay.
And none of my brothers are, and neither am I. But
oh boy.
It's okay. It's all
are
fine.
Are you the outcast?
I was for a little bit. I was
you better
the first
sell
one.
This. You have a half an hour.
No, it's all fine now.
I know.
But I came back and I started to study for medicine again. And I sort of caught this restaurant bug. I was also working as a bartender just on the side. In Pittsburgh, yeah. And I started
to... But you said
to,
caught the restaurant buzz. Was it there or
yeah,
just...
it was in Pittsburgh. Okay. I don't know what it was. I got in my just head that like I wanted it. To be a bartender. Like I just decided, I was like, well, I need to do something on the side. I'm going to be a bartender. So I started doing that. I poetically like romanticized it and was like, oh, I studied alchemical metaphors in Renaissance literature. Now I'm bartending, duh, whatever. And, but then I started to fall in love with wine as well. And then at a certain point I just had to like make a decision. I started to see wine as this extension of all the things that I loved studying. I realized it was as academic a pursuit as anything I had done before. And I also saw that I would reach a path to be a teacher and an entertainer in a way at a much quicker pace if I did this. And so I sort of shifted my focus and decided to go wholeheartedly into wine. And then I was working in a small restaurant called Bar Marco in Pittsburgh for a number of years. And I was working there when I came to New York on a whim to visit some friends.
Did Bar Marco have a decent wine program?
We had a natural wine program.
We
that
did.
Was my that was my intro to the
okay.
wine world. So let
what
me tell
year
you
what was that?
I started there in gosh, what year was that? 2011, 2012, something
okay.
like that. And 2014, I came to New York on a whim to visit some friends. Happened to meet Aldo through an introduction through...
The whim was not to relocate or
no,
to
I had no desire to ever live
job.
In New York.
You just
nope.
were visiting, hang.
Correct.
Okay,
and,
so...
And I was a surprise that my cousins brought me to eat at the bar at La Bernadette, which was... I was like, wow, I didn't realize you liked me that much. And I didn't... I also didn't know that they knew Aldo. And so they called him over. I was like so starstruck and intimidated by him.
You knew of him?
Of course.
Of course.
And I followed him on Twitter, you know?
Right.
And,
now
he,
Instagram.
Yeah, now Instagram. And, at the time, Twitter, yeah, I think. And they told him that I was a sommelier, and I was like, no, I'm not, just don't look at me. And he blind tasted me on my meal, which was like the most harrowing experience of my life.
But casually.
I mean, he was super nice about it, but I was nervous, obviously. I mean, he's Aldo.
Right.
He was super nice about it, though, but he never told me what any of the wines were. But, you know, fast forward, by the end of the meal, he never told me what I got right or wrong, but he did start to talk to me about my career, and he said, you know, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, maybe I'm going to move to Philadelphia. And he, like, laughed at me. He was like, okay.
Like, if you're from Western Pennsylvania,
yeah.
Philadelphia is, like, where you wind up.
Yeah, I never had it in my head that I wanted right. to be here. And I had a great opportunity there, actually. I mean, like, there's great restaurants there.
Yes.
And a great opportunity. And he said, you know, well, you know, if I offered you a job here, would you ever consider moving to New York? And I started laughing. And then I stopped
That's
laughing, and I realized he wasn't laughing. And I was like, oh, yeah, sure. And he goes, all right, email me. And then I did. And he said, do you want to come in and meet us? I'm opening a wine bar, and I think you'd be a great fit. So it was that all within the span of, like, 2 days.
Wow.
I met him and I came in and he said, all right, can you start? Can we have staff training in a month?
Wow.
I was like, okay. And
so
then I moved to New York.
A couple of things. That was 5 years ago this month, I think.
Yeah.
And I think the second thing is that the fact that he was opening a wine bar was a good segue to get in. And,
oh, totally.
Right?
I don't know
if you would have been right for Le Bernardin at that moment.
I certainly wouldn't have been. I was at the wine bar for 9 months, and I honestly think it was like boot camp for me to the New York wine scene.
Yeah.
Because it was, from the day the place opened, it was, you know, every Sam in the city was coming in, all of those winemakers, people that I've only read about and followed, and I was so starstruck, first of all. Second, the pace is completely different from anything I'd done before. And third, just the expanse of the wine list, the what is available in New York City was just like, it was literally a crash course boot camp. I was exhausted and terrified and tired pretty much every night, but I loved it also. I was so addicted to it.
It was feeding.
It was, oh my gosh, I was so driven by it. And Aldo gave me such good advice because he could see a couple times that I would just get really stressed. I wasn't sure I was doing things correctly. I wasn't sure I was good enough. And Aldo said, New York's going to make you the sharpest you've ever been in your life. But just make sure that doesn't grind you too fine because then you become useless. And
advice.
I've held that. That was, he told me that I think one of the first weeks that I moved here.
I think we'll talk about that a little later too. I think because it was Aldo had an impact, you know, on your ascension. Could have been someone else with not that type of empathy or thought process.
Totally.
Right? I mean, kudos to Aldo.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, even from that then to the transition to Le Bernardin after, like, I think 9 months at the wine bar, even that, like, it was another crash course into wine. But he, exactly to your point, he was an empathetic guide for all of it.
Now, I'd ask Katya this, because she had come from Austria to the States and to Le Bernardin. You were in Western Pennsylvania and at one good restaurant. I mean, had you tasted a lot of different wines and regions? Had you tasted through a decent amount of Burgundies and Bordeaux's? Because when you come here, it's all there.
Yeah.
Except for maybe some Italians. But were you, was this a big, not step up, but a big exposure to wines that you had
never... Huge exposure. I mean, I wasn't tasting super classic wines for sure. We tasted really widely. I would say we had
and natural
and
too.
Yeah, and
so you were in that.
I was in that camp initially, and it was my intro into wine. For a lot of the romanticism behind it, right? The stories and whatnot. But we did taste widely there, but not classic.
Right.
And so definitely when I came here, it was a massive exposure, and I was burning through this list. Like, I loved it. It was a lot of fun for me.
Remind me of this, because it's been in the newspapers or magazine articles and all of that. It's not a controversy, but the issue of, at fine dining, when you order a bottle of wine, do you taste the wine first? Do you now defer to the customer? Do you give it to, because there's, in the stories, there's like, I wanted to taste that first. You know, why did you open it? What's the protocol?
Well, here, I mean, for me, I always encourage people to remember that this is actually a courtesy to the guest, because I'm not trying to drink your wine, certainly.
No.
Most
customers know that, but there's that one.
It's literally just to make sure that you're having the best expression of this bottle. And here we do have the ability to, if it's not showing absolutely perfectly, I don't want you to drink it. So we just taste what we can to make sure that the wine is showing as we think it's appropriate. And then we do also offer a taste to the guest, because at that point, at least we know then that the wine is showing correctly. But if it's not to the guest's liking, no questions asked, we'll take it away and do something else or bring another bottle. It's not a problem here.
I mean, I don't want to waste time asking this question, but I'm so curious. So you guys are literally trained palates. How often do you know a wine is good and the customer says, this isn't good, and you know
it doesn't matter,
but is it all more often than you'd think, or no?
I mean, I think that people trust us. I think when it comes down to it, if someone doesn't like something, I don't ask, I don't question. Like, at that point, I know if the wine's good or not.
That's
don't
why they're here.
We're just here for them to have the best experience possible. So whatever moves the experience in a positive direction,
because we'll every now and then you get a customer who's a know-it-all, or you know, wants to make an impression in front of people, and it's your job to sort of handle that.
It's my job to step away and let them live their lives.
As I've been doing the show, and this is our third year,
We have the luxury in New York of everybody coming through, authors, producers, and the best sommeliers, you know, in the world. And even in the 3 years I've been doing this show, it almost seems like there's a new guard of sommeliers. And I kind of put you in that category.
Thank you.
And that, you know, all the vitals, younger, you know, not doing this forever, a different point of view. I mean, do you agree with that to any extent? You're in the most traditional of places, yeah. But, I mean, do you feel you bring a new perspective or...
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think that that's one of the biggest strengths of our team. I think certainly people are sometimes surprised, actually, when they walk in and they see the diversity on our team of women, of people from different backgrounds, of different age groups. And I always say that in any team, a diversity of perspectives is only going to strengthen any program. It also increases the guest experience because now you have a wealth of backgrounds, knowledge levels, experience levels to draw on to make a guest experience more personal and more approachable.
I think that's so well said. And I think that's the reality that should be. I don't think it necessarily exists as much as we'd like it to. You know, I think when you walk into wine programs, there's still a lot of men. The diversity isn't necessarily there. So it's really nice to see that. And I think, you know, you articulated that right. And again, you know, kudos to Alan, Aldo. Do you think being a young woman, not just a woman, a young woman, a woman of color in this business has any disadvantage? I mean, do you, the old stories, you walk up to a table for wine service and they go send the somm over?
It's happened, but it doesn't really bother me that much. I've never really known any other way, you know.
Right, so, right. You're comfortable with yourself,
and
you know.
I'm lucky. I think we have a very receptive. We have very receptive guests. We have very kind guests. New York is so diverse. I know that I can only speak from my own experience. You know, certainly there's some uncomfortable questions here and there that I wish would go away. Things like, you know, what it's where people ask people like me, like, well, what are you? Or like, where did you come from? And they don't believe me when I say Pittsburgh. And it, those kind of things often feel like you're having to prove why you're here. Even if it does come from a point of like curiosity about your background, sometimes I think half is sincere curiosity,
and the other half is what the
and,
you know.
No, and you know what? To be completely honest, I choose to take 100% of those questions as I always assume the best intentions whenever I get those. So for me, it's like it doesn't bother me. I don't see a disadvantage to being me. No.
No. I agree with that. And I think it's obvious at a restaurant like this, you have to conduct yourself, you know, at a certain level, which is what's expected of this type of service price. You know, the customer wants that. Maybe in another place you could say, hey, buddy, you want to step outside? But, you know, not it. But you
yeah,
wouldn't
well, they
do
take
that
me
anyway.
Very seriously. They hired me for my muscle here, obviously. So
yeah, obviously. Before we talk about Calamata's Kitchen, I wanted to ask you a couple other things about Little Bernadine. This is a traditional wine list for good reason, skews French for good reason. I think we all agree the wine world is changing. I think there's emerging regions that are getting high praise and are interesting. And I also think there's this natural wine movement going on, which, you know, I'm glad you had brought it up that you had some exposure. How does that play into a place like Le Bernardine? Katya and I talked about it a little, but how do you, is the clientele asking for it? Is it, like I asked Katya, is it up to you to push it there? Is natural wine, whole separate show, but is it a good fit for the clientele? I mean, how do you view what's going on with what's going on in the world and what's going on here? They're the same world, but they are also two worlds.
Yeah, same world, but two worlds is correct. I mean, at the end of the day, the wine has to taste good for it to be on our list. So we do have some natural producers and biodynamic producers and on the list, but they're generally not people who like tout themselves as such.
Right.
It's not the gimmicks.
That's
the wine.
Whole other show.
And it's a whole different. That's a whole different conversation.
Right.
At the end of the day, if the wine tastes good, it's a good fit with our food. It maybe exposes people to a region that we're excited about, and then we'll consider it. And as Katya said, I think that we do have a pretty traditional guests, I think, traditional drinkers, but we also have a lot of those people who are very open, who've come to trust us, who are very open to trying new things. And I think I've learned a ton about like really cool Spanish wines recently, because that's an area that Aldo and Katya decided to dive into in the last year or so.
It's a good
and
call.
It's been awesome.
Because
I mean,
there's a rich amount of product coming out.
Absolutely. Amazing young producers, great values. And also, I think it's really important to remember that here, while we do sell some extremely valuable bottles and the collector bottles and the unicorn bottles, we have bottles at $45 to $60 as well. We have bottles in every price range for the people who are coming in and who are, this is a very special experience for them. We want them to leave with the happiest possible feeling. As you said earlier, no bottle shock. I think all of us are, that's what another one of the strengths of the team is. I think we're very good at reading where people are comfortable. It helps when they're very honest up front about their price points.
Express
and
yourself.
Knowing that, I think people are very pleasantly surprised sometimes when they look at the list and they see that, oh, you can buy a bottle for $60. Not only can you, we're all excited about it, and it's going to be delicious. One of my favorite bottles on the list is $90, and I'm like, this is great.
Would you say what it is?
The Guazzo Bourgogne Blanc. We pour it by the glass.
Who's the maker?
Guazzo.
Spell.
It's from the Côte d'Azur. Oh, spell it G-O-I-S-O-T.
Okay.
Right?
Guazzo. So spelling that's test. Here. I mean, if you went out retail, it's a terrific value.
Yeah.
Obviously, right?
It's I mean, if you find it, I think we bought it all. Sorry.
Oh, you did? All of you?
Well, come here
I'll
and drink it.
I'll have to follow you home and take a few. I think one of the great points you made is that when you walk into fine dining restaurants, you get intimidated, but those restaurants have access to some of the best wines that everyone else doesn't have at that price range, and more interesting. You know, so there's a lot of surprises there. You'd mentioned a growth in Spanish wines, which parts of Spain are emerging. You know, certainly Rioja's been around. But what would you like to see on the list? You know, if at the meeting they said, okay, Sarah, what are we putting on? I mean, what would make you happy?
That's a great question. I don't know. I mean, I love the expansion of our like Galician section. That's been a region that's always fascinated me.
Spain again.
But
very specific.
Oh, yeah, sort of. Yeah, sorry. I guess you know what?
Not
I,
you specific.
I went to
Galicia is very specific of
right.
the other wines of Spain.
Right, right. You know, I went to Corsica like 2 years ago, and we do have a couple Corsican wines on that are delicious.
Papatucci and those guys.
Yeah, and the Siciliano, and you know those wines are just tasty and delicious.
Yeah.
And they're you know island wines, right? So the whites, the reds, and the rosés are often really compatible with a lot of our food. So yeah, a lot of.
I think
stuff.
To your point, and you pull Corsica out. There's a handful of cool regions, you know, that are making wine. So it's not that easy of a question to answer. All right, let's talk about Kalamata's Kitchen. It's a very special project of yours. You know, in all the research I did, I'm like, here's the easy question. Explain what it is.
Sure.
It's a book, but it's evolved into more than a book. It's a thing. So
yeah.
Tell me about that.
So Kalamata's Kitchen as a company overall seeks to introduce children to diverse cultures and experiences through adventures with food. And we looked out at the sort of landscape of kids, foods, and food and parents. And there's a lot of instructional things on like for a parent to get their kid to do something like with food, to trick them into eating broccoli or whatever. And in all of those instructional things, which are obviously very useful as well, we just noticed that there wasn't anything speaking directly from the child's perspective. So my business partner, Derek Wallace, actually had this idea to create a character that would be the vehicle to translate stories and lessons, but from a child's perspective. And that's how Kalamata and her sidekick, alligator pal Al Dente, were born. And so it started with, we decided we wanted to write storybooks. We now have three out, the third being with Chef Eric Repair. And they're adventure stories. So Kalamata gets whisked away by a food memory of the chef, and she creates her own adventure. And through that, she learns how to taste different foods, how to experience different cultures and cuisines. And the lesson of every story is that she wants to come back and share that with her own family. We also do restaurant guides in different, we have 15 live in different cities where we target restaurants that create special food experiences for children. They treat the kid as the same way that they treat their adult patrons. And also, the food's delicious for both kids and adults.
It sounds like, and tell me if there's any of this, I mean, it seems obvious to me, but I could be wrong, there's a little or a lot of you. Was that you to any extent? That curiosity and just looking at the world through a certain lens? You know, this being food. I mean, yeah. how much of that is in there?
Well, I always say that Kalamata is like way cooler than I was as a kid.
Well, if you were born today, you'd be cool. You just weren't cool then.
I was not cool then.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I definitely grew up in a very food-rich household. And my parents, as I said before, are South Indian. My parents are both amazing cooks and amazing hosts. So the smells of the kitchen, the smells of cooking, whenever we traveled, all of our vacations were centered around what we were eating. That very much influenced how I felt about the world, to the point where I made it my career. As I grew up, I realized that I was very lucky to have that, particularly in Western Pennsylvania. It's not a normal thing. And so a lot of this is my way to get back into working with children and to maybe expose another generation of kids to what made my childhood so special.
Right. So you're using food as a bridge.
Correct.
To, you know, the experience, the diverse experience.
Exactly.
People love rock stars as role models, guys like Aldo Soma role models, but I guess you put a chef as a role model here.
Exactly.
Why?
Right.
I mean, not questioning, but explain why.
Sure. Take a chef of course we know our rock star chefs, right? But take a chef in a small food community like Pittsburgh or
Portland.
That's
the gist of what this is all about, to some extent.
This is community building in a lot of ways, and we see chefs, especially in small food smaller communities, as community leaders. And as you said, kids often see athletes and rock stars as their heroes. They're very inaccessible heroes. It's an amazing thing for a kid to be able to go into a local restaurant and see a successful business owner and also like artist in a lot of ways, leading a team of people and changing the communities around them. And that's how we wanted to portray these people as community leaders, as heroes, as people that kids can look up to and also meet and emulate.
And they're around.
They're around. You can go in and meet your heroes.
From a diner,
that's pretty cool.
To a fancy restaurant.
Exactly.
To a burger joint and all of that.
Exactly.
Interestingly, the project got off the ground as a Kickstarter thing.
It did. Yeah.
How was it presented? Like when you, if you went on Kickstarter and you saw this, you go, Kalamata is what? You know, what was the pitch on Kickstarter?
The pitch on Kickstarter was pretty much what I said earlier. And yeah, I mean, it was
as a book initially and community.
Yeah, well, it was launched with the book.
Right.
At the time we launched our Kickstarter, we also had our products. We had, we had the aprons, we had little chef's tools, we have roll-ups for kids, all really high-quality chef's tools. And so initially, I think that stuff was pitched and people thought it was specifically a cooking brand, that like Kalamata's Kitchen was a cookbook.
Right.
Which, in hindsight, we can see why that was the perception.
And it's morphed in that direction to some extent.
We have one recipe per book, but really it's never been, the center has never been on kids cooking, per se.
Right.
It's more about
But even outside of the book, I mean.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about cooking.
Of course. Well, we talk about cooking as an activity that
right.
for family bonding time. And it's more about all food experiences, whether that's eating out or eating at home or cooking something or going to a market.
Right.
That, but yeah,
that was sort of my point. What is next? You the Eric Repair book's been out how long?
Not that long. We launched it May? I think
yeah.
May.
Yeah, this spring.
Yeah.
So it's still this year. What's next? More books? Bigger community building? I mean, where do you see this thing if I sit with you a year or two from now?
Well, I mean, fingers crossed. There's a lot of things on the table right now. We're definitely building out our travel guide in a big way. So we've been doing a lot of outreach.
Good response to that?
Yes.
I mean, you gravitate towards that because of the response, right?
Yeah, exactly. Good. We've had parents are, that's a real need that we identified, that parents who like food themselves want to know when they visit cities where to eat, but they also want to know where they want to eat that they can also take their kids.
Right.
So we provided a resource where we've gone in and actually asked the chefs and restaurant owners, do you like when families come here? And they've been cool. Yes, we wish more people knew that. So we're providing that resource. We're also hopefully developing into maybe a television show, potentially, definitely, you know, more books. There's a lot going on.
I'm surprised you don't do a podcast.
Yeah, maybe that too.
Yeah.
I don't want to step on any toes. Right,
so, two things. If people want to know more about Kalamata's Kitchen, where can they go?
Go to kalamataskitchen.com.
KALAMATAS.
Kitchen.
Not kitchen. .com. And the book, get anywhere? Amazon stores?
And on our website.
Your site.
Yes.
All right, so that's Kalamata's Kitchen, a very exciting project, obviously from the heart. All right, we're going to wrap up, but I'm not going to let you get away without doing your portion of the wine list, okay? So we ask everyone 5 questions. We're splitting them up. I added a 6th one, so it's 2 each. So here's one of the questions. What are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you tasting? What's seasonal? Anything here? I mean, what are the few things?
Well, I'm so busy these days, I haven't really been drinking a ton at home, but I do always have champagne at home because...
So champagne.
Yeah, always have something. And then, when I'm only ever really home for like a night, usually with my fiance, like, and we'll try and cook at home, and he loves like light, juicy reds. So I actually do have a bunch of Corsican wines.
Give me an
wines.
Example of what you guys define as light, juicy reds, even specific to the maker.
Sure. What do we have? I had the Guimaro Mencia, actually, we just talked about. I always have that. Casella di Verduno, Pella Verga, the Domaine Ustellaciano Antica. And these are all like pretty inexpensive bottles. Right. Always have Beaujolais around. Especially like getting into this
struggled
weather.
A little. You gave me 10 different examples, which is what I was looking for. All right, last question. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar?
Ooh.
Outside of here. Let's put this top of the list. Great restaurant, great wine list, great wine people, great, you know, all of that. But if you were go to hang somewhere, whether it's just a bar or a restaurant, what comes to mind? And I always worry, you're not being exclusive. If you leave somebody out, that doesn't mean you didn't like them or you don't go there. But who does it well?
Well, I mean, I think one of the great values of New York is there's just so many, like, such, like, incredible wine professionals here. So I try and, like, seek out where like, those people are. I mean, the wealth of knowledge that is at Racine with Pascaline and Arnaud is just...
It's a show favorite.
It's unbelievable. I just love going there.
When she was at Rouge Tomato, it was the same.
Yeah. I just feel like we're very lucky that she and Arnaud are both like there all the time and like on the floor. I mean,
she's traveling the world. I think she's in South America.
I've been
America
lucky.
Now.
I've caught her the last few times I'm there, and she's always such a generous.
Anything else
teacher.
Come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, if I want to like revisit my natural wine roots a little bit, I always go to Gloria, Phil Johnson, former sommelier here at the
He's
wine bar.
He's a former.
And, yeah, he was.
He was an opener
at the Aldosan Wine Bar, and has Gloria in.
Gloria's a seafood restaurant on the west side in the Theater District.
Yeah, in Hell's Kitchen.
Anything else? You don't have to.
Wine bar. I don't go out very much.
Okay. Well, we understand.
I also really like going and sitting at the bar at the Modern.
Right.
Yeah.
I love when Michael Engelman was there, and it'll still be
still a great team.
All right, Sarah, we're going to wrap up. Thank you for sitting with us. You have a lot of stuff going on, and like I said, I'll post your wine list answers and info about the book just to remind people. So thank you to Sarah Thomas for joining us on The Grape Nation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Jenna Liute, and I'm the host of Eating Matters here on HRN. Join me as I talk to food systems experts about the issues that shape our experiences of buying, cooking, and eating food. You can find Eating Matters wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Marie Poncinette is a sommelier at Le Bernardine and now a winemaker, releasing her first vintage of Collet Merlot. Collet or Colette?
Colette.
Colette.
Please.
All right. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Marie.
Thank you.
All right. So you're one of the people at the table that have been literally surrounded by wine in your upbringing and your family. Give us a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you here to Le Bernardine, which you've been doing for a while, and then your personal project, Colette, which Merlot will talk about and taste a little later on in the show. So tell me how you got here.
It hasn't been that straight forward, actually.
Okay.
Yes, I'm born in a family of winemakers in Pomerol in Bordeaux, surrounded by vineyards. I'm the eighth generation of winemakers in this family, and I loved my childhood growing up in this vineyard, being part of all the vine cycle, being part of the harvest, being part of the stress also of my father,
right,
worrying all the time. But I didn't study wine at first. I studied communication, I studied marketing. And then I was already in Paris. I moved to Paris, and then I actually missed wine a lot, and I didn't find my job interesting enough or my studies interesting enough. I needed to apply them to something that talked to me, and it's how really I considered wine again, and I needed to go back to my roots. So I worked in the wine events. It was still on the marketing side, but it's how I met so many
this
wine
makers. This is in Paris still?
It was in Paris. It's still,
okay.
Yes. It's
okay.
A private wine club of
right.
businessmen that love wine, and they are collectors. And they meet every month to meet winemakers. So literally we had French winemakers coming to Paris every month to talk about their wines, to also talk with the chef about pairing. We were working with three Michelin stars in Paris. So it's really how also I reconnected with wine, meeting other winemakers than Bordeaux winemakers, and outside of my roots in Bordeaux, being in Paris.
Right. But the funny thing is, you were in the business world, but it was, you were in communications, events, radio. I mean, that's a fun part of the business.
It's
just you had that yearning to go back to wine?
Yes, because it's at some point, you know, you keep talking about wine, and you don't make it, and I mean, to me, maybe because of my roots, something sounds like fake
right.
to me. I was almost at my right place, but not enough. So it was great to talk about wine, to do all of these fancy events, but
right.
I needed to go back to my real roots, and I went back to Bordeaux, actually, to study more wine for a year and a half.
What did you do specifically? What were
it
you
was
studying?
It was still marketing oriented, but a tasting part was really important. It was with a business school, but they had this dedicated service for wine.
Right. Did that deem useful to you? I mean, was that worth?
I think actually practicing and being on site in a winery is the best experience and the most
right.
useful by far.
Now, when you go back to the family winery, your dad and sister are still there, right?
Yes, my dad, yes, he grew up there. Is
well, paint a picture. It's very, you know, wine could be a glamorous industry or item, but I mean, your dad is basically a farmer in a very rural area, right?
Completely.
I mean, set that up for me a little. I mean, what's it like when you go back?
I love the image of my father. He's civilized, huh? Don't get me wrong.
I never said it was uncivilized. I just said there ain't a lot of people around.
Yes, you know, he's a really funny person for Bordeaux landscape, because he has no cell phone. He has no emails. We do have a computer.
Still,
yes.
Wow.
And he don't want to. We once forced him to have a cell phone for hard conditions, to have,
right.
to have a cell phone on him. He always left it in his bedroom, you know.
Right.
So he's a strong mind. He grew up on the vineyard. He makes wine since he's 14 years old. He knows everything on the vineyard. But my sister came in 2009, early 2009.
because, you know, you need also fresh blood and new energy and new perspective. So he was the happiest man in the world.
He was very happy to see her come.
Completely.
That's so nice. Completely. How old is your father?
He's 72.
He's still a young guy.
Yeah. I love to hear that.
Yeah. And do you go back from time to time? I mean,
I'm trying once to.
You don't as much as you'd like to.
I'd love to, but yes.
Whether it's harvest or.
Yes, I'd love to go back for the harvest, but it's not that easy, unfortunately.
Right. And then when do you come to New York?
Yeah, so I came, I moved to New York in 2013.
Not that long ago.
No, but yes, and I started with at a restaurant called Le Colonial.
Still there, isn't it?
It's still there.
Yeah, Vietnamese French.
Yes, yeah. And thanks to one of the owners, Jean Goutal, I had my first visa to work in New York, and I was doing a little bit everything, including the wine buying. And it's really how I got to taste so many different wines. Sarah was mentioning the massive exposure we get in New York. And I was completely amazed by all of those wines. I had no clue. I felt so naive at first. And thank God I started with this step at Le Colonial to just be silent and do my homework and get to know people. I had no clue what people were doing, or I really was ignorant at first when I moved here. So for a year at Le Colonial.
It's funny, you literally have wine in your blood. From growing up, but when you come to the real wine world, there's so much ahead of you, right?
Completely.
Especially in New York.
Yeah, because, you got to realize, you know, French people, we can be sometimes a little self-centered. No offense here, but I got to realize also that Bordeaux or French wine are not the only best wine in the world. So
right.
I knew it, but I was really facing it moving here.
What, and then just take me to the end. So you're at Le Colonial for a couple of years.
Yeah, a year.
And how does the Le Bernardine Aldo thing come about?
So thanks actually to another sommelier, Renée. She was actually working here for a short time. But it was right before the wine bar opened. And she knew the team was not complete. Aldo was still looking for sommelier. I didn't have the classical sommelier background, but I was really pushing my knowledge and myself to the wine industry, and I gave my resume. So had an interview with Aldo and the management, and I was with Sarah. I was part of the opening.
So
team.
You and Sarah were here at the opening.
Yes, since day one.
You two buddies.
Yeah.
That's
and
nice.
We celebrated actually last week the fifth year anniversary of the wine bar. So it was something.
I saw that. And how long did you stay at the wine bar?
A year. And then I started full-time at Le Bernardin on Le Bernardin's floor.
How does that happen? Somebody dies or gets fired or quits? I mean, how does a job open up?
I keep bothering Aldo.
You did?
Yeah.
When the wine bar opened and you guys came in, and obviously I'm talking to you because you're all great guys, did he expand the team just because the talent, or the team was always the size that it is now, as
at
far
Le Bernardin,
as the amount of sommeliers?
I think we have a slightly more
you
today,
do.
But it's
That's
it, it was you know, almost the same number, but luckily Le Bernardin is so busy that you need a big team of sommeliers.
So this is your fifth year, almost to the month.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
August, September, whenever you came. That's a nice thing in this business. I'm curious because you had the luxury of working or living in the family winery and working in Paris for years. Do you see much of a difference between the wine scene in Paris and in New York?
I do. Even if I was not really totally working in a restaurant in Paris, so I was not.
But you were around.
But
the
I
scene,
saw them. I
so,
was
you
absolutely.
Know, a wider view.
So I think I can compare, and the humility. I mean, New York is strong, and I think you have to really fight for it. But New York still has humility and curiosity about wine, which sometimes I don't want to be critical though, but. You know, we have so many traditions and classical tradition and frame in France that we can just sometimes forget to look around.
Right.
And here you have no choice than looking around, because if you're behind, your next guest will tell you, do you know this wine? and you have to be a little bit, you cannot know everything, but you have to be a little bit ahead of it.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about that with Sarah. You have to accommodate that classic wine lover who expects that, but also your clientele is looking to you for the next thing or, you know, things they've heard about outside. When you got to Paris and even New York, I mean, did all you know about was Bordeaux? it's a silly question, or no, even Merlot.
I love the question because, yes, pretty much.
You were not trying or drinking. There was not much exposure to anything.
It's
so you had mentioned Le Colonel.
Le Colonel was a great exposure because I got, suddenly I got this title of not sommelier. I didn't want to be someone I'm not. I am not, but
wine
I had
service.
This title of wine buyer. So it was fantastic to be invited to all those tastings that you have weekly. But when I moved to Paris first, I knew only about Bordeaux. Started to then expand a little bit still to French wine regions. And then coming here, it was like a shock.
What do you remember being the things that you wanted to try the most, knew the least about, or excited you? I mean, what was it? Burgundy? Was it Champagne? I mean, what?
I think at
what,
first
what
it
really
was.
What really turned you on?
At first, I think it was Loire Valley.
Really?
Yes. But I mean, when you come from a wine region, especially Bordeaux, you know, you drink Bordeaux, and you even winemakers between them don't really host wine dinners. It's a very different wine region. It has beautiful qualities, but also not every winemaker live on site in Bordeaux. So it's not the same wine culture than in other French wine region. When I moved here in New York, I think tasting so many Loire wines, this diversity, this beautiful expression of the terroir, no makeup on it, really true to them, really blew my mind.
Do you still feel that way now?
Yes, completely.
I mean, your palate has opened to many more wines.
Yes.
The Loire was something early on that...
Totally. And also, you know, definitely the influence of Pascaline I started to meet her. I saw also, I listened to her. It was definitely not shaping my mind, but opening my eyes also to Loire. Then Sarah mentioned it earlier, but I fell in love with Corsican wine. I fell in love with Canary Island wines and all those regions that started to have... to offer good values and identity.
The Canary Islands, it's crazy what they're doing there. We had the Envinate guys on.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, they're just walking up and down these hills. They're in the middle of nowhere. They have to fly on planes. I mean, it's just... but the wines are very, you know, cool and very nuanced. They're very nice.
Yes.
I had asked Sarah and Katja sort of about the same topic here, but I wanted to ask you... At Le Bernardin, you're surrounded by a strong, supportive cast. You know, how do you pronounce her name? Maggie, and, you know, Aldo certainly is very much into, you know, diversity and appreciates women in the business. Do you think, and I ask Katja this too, do you think women in the wine business are treated equally like men? Do you feel there's been any disadvantage, whether it's working here or, you know, launching a wine business?
I feel like, talking with my experience, maybe we are a little spoiled here. But we have definitely managers, Maggie, Aldo, who are not doing any difference, you know. The only time I may have feel a difference is... when I was pregnant on the floor, and it was absolutely fine, and all the management was fine with that, and it was one of the best experiences actually that I had. I didn't know I was that strong, but I didn't. I think maybe because it's New York, and it's modern. It's so.
I think this culture, because of Aldo, and I think New York. You're right. I think there are still issues, you know, in the industry. It's still male-dominated.
Sure. We still see more male wine directors,
for
sure.
Is there much of a difference between here and Europe, France?
I think so, a little bit. Yeah, still.
Still
it's starting to
more.
Move. We can compare to big star Michelin star places. I still think it's more male dominated, but moving slowly, moving forward.
Yeah, I think it's definitely happening. You know, I hear that from all my guests.
I also think, you know, because we keep, it's a topic that comes back so often. It's funny also, over the past year, we had often this question. But I also think it really depends on the person, male or man or woman. It also depends on what you want to share as message. I don't feel oppressed.
Right.
You know, Sarah is from, as is.
I think it originates from within and, you know, yes, out. And then luckily, if you're in the right culture, surrounded by the right people.
It comes back to you. Yes, I think
so. You know, how you approach things, how strong you are, how you view it, how you handle it. I think that's a very good point. And I think, you know, in life, that's kind of where it starts. All right, I wanted to talk to you about Colette, which is a very interesting project. You got to sort of segue into this with the classic American question, why Merlot?
Yes, it was it risky to do that?
No, you know, the whole sideways movie thing and the shift away from Merlot
but
and
when
Pinot
was
Noir.
That? It was, what, 2004?
Okay.
Yes.
It's already 15 years.
Can you
years.
Believe we're still talking about that? But yeah. I love that actually.
But that's old news.
So,
you know,
if I decided to make Colette, it's not to talk about sideways. I watched one of the movies.
Well,
but it's definitely something that triggered me a little bit. That's true. Merlot, I'm very much attached to my roots, and actually it came stronger when I moved here. I valued them much more, and I was almost so ashamed to not realize earlier that I had this chance to grow up on this terroir like Pomerol. Here, you do have still a little Bordeaux bashing in New York, which is still happening, but definitely less strong.
It's been going on for a while.
Yes, when I moved 6 years ago, it was still strong, and you know, a lot of Bordeaux jokes. And I'm all good with that. I can be part of it too. But I was everything also continued with the stage I did in 2015 at Sandy and Domaine de la Côte in Santa Barbara.
Raja Parr.
Yes, and Sashi Moorman. And their winemaker assistant, John Faulkner. I had to meet such an amazing team. And really, so I thought I was ignorant, but I was even more ignorant when I started the internship with them. So it was Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, also so many grapes that Raj always wants to experience. But I focused on Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. It was fantastic, and to see them approach as well. And after this stage, I started to joke and not joke at the same time, but telling Raj, I think we should do Pomerol style, at least, I mean, a Bordeaux grape together, but from California. He was laughing at first, but never say never, you know. And he found the vineyard. It took 2 years,
so
and he found the vineyard.
When the idea first hatched, it took 2 years to then find the vineyard, the terroir, to match what you wanted to do.
Exactly.
And what were you looking for?
The ultimate condition was to have organic grapes to really find. So in Napa, we were not too specific on the area, but it happened that the grape we wanted, the quality of grape we wanted, we found them in Napa. And the condition was,
which is not famous for organics or biodynamics.
Exactly.
Napa.
It took us a while. It took us 2 years.
You know, they need to make that shift. They are, but
they are. But it takes time, as you know.
So you found a.
So we found a little bit of grapes, Merlot, organic, that we were able to buy 2 tons at first, and the first vintage is 2017, so just released now.
And how much of it did you make?
It's about 1,100 bottles, so
it's
very new. Colette is starting small, but has ambition. And
So, what about 18? Did you make an 18?
Same. We did make 18,
right.
So it's still aging right now in barrels. So
Same quantity. Same vineyard site?
So same size actually, but from 2017 we had a vineyard, and then we found in 2018 a vineyard that really matched it even more our requirements, much more volcanic soil, a little bit cooler area in Combsville exactly. So 2 farmers are working this soil and are doing an amazing job to rejuvenate the soil. So 2019, this year, should see a little more yield. Not in a bad way, I mean, just yeah. vine happy yeah. and giving a little bit more fruit.
Are you okay with, if the quality is up to par, you want to increase the yield, right? I mean, you would like to make more wine.
Yes, right? Of course, but as long as it's true to the vines, we won't do something,
right.
you know.
Right. That's
especially Merlot can be tricky. The edge is to not have a flat Merlot, lack of complexity, so the yielding part is super important with Merlot.
Let's go backwards for a second, because an important part of this wine, and certainly your part in this, you know, project, is Raja Par. Mm. How did you and Raja get together initially? Through the biz or
yes,
introduction?
Yes,
I mean, when was that point?
No, that's interesting, because we met at the La Pole in San Francisco. I was still at Le Colonial.
Were you both working it, or you were just tasting?
Yes, okay. Both working it. It was my first Pole. I was still at Le Colonial, so just moved fresh from freshly arrived.
That's like 2000.
It was 2013 or 14. I mean, I moved
probably
in 13.
Right.
And one of the after party, you know, the after party of La Pole,
that's
the best.
Famous.
One of them was at RN74.
Rush.
And I was, Rush,
like
yes. And I was there, and I was tasting a lot of wine that he was pouring, passing along so many glasses. I was so lost, but everything was so delicious all the time. And I was, who is this guy? Who is this guy? I didn't even know, because again, I was just, you know, I was freshly arrived also from France. And then we exchanged our card, because we started to have this discussion. We exchanged our contacts. I came back to New York, and I was like, I'm sure I know this face. I know this face. And you know, when you're so new in an industry, I didn't even dare to ask, who is this guy? So I came back to New York, I looked at my books, and I saw his face on one of the cover.
Right.
I was so embarrassed.
Right.
So
it's okay.
It
He's
happened.
The type of guy that doesn't, you know, bother. He's such a grounded
But it
person.
Was really how we met, and I love actually that it was really with no hidden intention behind.
It's funny, for all you kids at home, Raj Par, I don't think he has any wine certification, and he's considered one of the best palates in the business. So you can get there in many routes, you know, whatever you want. That was important to him. But he became a winemaker, but he's a great taster. So what is it? Is it like your mission to make Bordeaux the great wine again? Because like you said, it's fallen out of favor to Burgundy for the big collectors, even though it's important. You know, Barolo's a big deal now. Natural wines are a big deal.
I think.
And convincing Raj, you know, to do that.
That was a big deal, too.
Yeah.
He's making Cabernet Sauvignon now.
Yes,
he's making more
that.
Bordeaux grapes.
He's actually expanding into other stuff.
Yes.
It's sort of a unicorn in the sense that it's you, it's Raj. There's not a lot of wine. I mean, if people want to try to get it or taste it, I mean, what are the best avenues for them to go down to taste this? Where can they get it?
So it's already, so Le Bernardin has it.
Okay.
It was actually,
I hope so.
Yes. Yeah.
I wish you told me earlier, because Aldo walked in. I would have tackled him if he didn't have it.
And I didn't even push too much, so I was really happy he bought it on his one. Thanks to Katia as well.
So it's at select restaurants.
Yes, so it's in restaurant already in New York. We're working on having the wine in wine stores right now.
Okay.
So it should happen in the next few weeks.
Okay.
We had a little part allocated to direct sales, so from the winery, which sold out really fast, but it was so small.
Is that your site, or was that Raj? If people want more information on the wine, where can they go? Is there a
to me, yes.
Okay.
And marie@colettewine.com.
Okay.
That's
so anyone interested in drinking it, or, you know, being involved with it, retail or on site, certainly reach out to Marie. And the 18 will hit the market?
It will stay a little longer in barrel, should be bottled around May.
Is that because of what you tasted on the first wine? It would be better in barrel, or
it's just be yes. So this Merlot needs time to develop for sure. It's beautiful to have this impression of fruit, of freshness, but we need also to work on the tannin. And on the next vineyard we found, from the 2018 vintage, the tannin are definitely present. So we need to work on that, but it's great structure. Also because we get inspiration a lot from my sister in Pomerol, we actually talked a lot, and we not applying like word per word, but we're doing a similar way.
Right, you have the luxury of tapping into your sister, yes, your dad, and all their experience. What's been the most frustrating thing about launching the wine, and what's been the most joyful?
The most frustrating is to not be able to be on site as much as I would like.
Because of what you do.
Because, yes, and yeah, it's also we have...
But
I have
no offense, at 1,100 bottles, you better have another job, you know?
Yes.
What's the joyful thing, seeing the product?
Seeing the bottle, the everything, you know, the label on it, the name, the opening the first bottle, so much joy and stress and nervosity at the same time, that was something.
Do you see your path similar to Raj's? I mean, do you see 3, 5, 7, 10 years from now you morph into a winemaker, or you would like to do both?
I want to do more winemaking. I would not, I think, experience too many grapes. I like to focus.
Right.
I'm a little exclusive, you know. And
it's a nice thing because of your family background.
Yes.
You could juggle both.
And I need time.
Focus on that. All right, so that's Colette wine. We're going to taste it in a minute. But before we wrap up, we do a thing called the wine list, where we ask all our guests questions about their preferences. I split it up amongst you guys, so you each have two questions. The first question from Marie's wine list is, what is your favorite all-time wine or wines? Now, when I first asked the question years ago, it used to be the most expensive, rare. That's BS now. It's the wine that created an experience or something. So it could be anything. That oh wow experience. What's your favorite all-time wine or wines?
This is so hard.
Then tell me whatever comes to your mind.
Okay. But I would say actually Corsica.
Corsica?
Yes, because getting...
So of all the wines you've tasted, Corsica's right up there on the top.
Yes, because
okay.
I don't know, with the
vetting
food,
it out.
With the food, they have something, and they are so unique.
So it's the environment, the food, the wine.
Absolutely.
That's important. That's experience.
For me,
it's not just an 61 Petrus.
No.
It's the whole package.
A wine that really blew my mind, if you want a name, and big name, it's Ikem 39.
Okay.
That I had the chance to try, and I was, wow, if only people could taste Ikem like this.
That's a special.
It's how it makes sense.
Was
but
that considered a great vintage, 39, or that's...
I don't remember, honestly. It was,
right?
But the wine was still showing beautiful and fruit, and it was great. But for me, the more I go, what I enjoy is the wine I can drink every day, and that give me pleasure, surprise, and complexity. And I can find them in beautiful Corsican wines.
Nice. All right, last question. Where do we find the best value in Bordeaux? Like, where does the average consumer, is it the smaller chateaus? Is it white? I mean...
I would say right now there is something interesting about Fronsac on the right bank.
Okay, that's what I'm looking for. So the Fronsac region, Fronsac.
Yes.
The wine's coming out of there. Why?
So it's not a new region, not at
no,
all.
No, I
it's
know.
Just that, you know,
no,
people
know.
People
I'm
are
sure a lot of people who drink Bordeaux never heard of it. But.
So right bank, dominant of Merlot, can be sometimes a little rustic, used to be very rustic. But if you look for the good production style winemaking, you start to have really interesting wine. Not everything is imported yet. So this is, I get the chance.
Good value?
Good value.
They're not expensive.
You have, in Pomerol, you have Chateau Lafleur, owned by the family Guinaudot. They do have wines. They
Fronsac.
Do have wine made in Fronsac. And they do also make a fantastic white wine, but it's labeled Bordeaux. It's not labeled Fronsac, you cannot. And those type of persons really understood the terroir. It's so different than any other part of the right bank. You have to really to adjust.
That's how you answer that question. So wines from Bordeaux, from Fronsac, good value, some good wines.
Yes.
All right, we're going to wrap the show up, but the reason we're talking to you last is I would like to raise a glass of the Colette and taste it, and let's evaluate it a little. So tell me a little more. 100% Merlot?
100% Merlot. 100% destemmed, so
destemmed.
Bordeaux style. Even if you feel a lot of freshness there, some people had an impression of not destemmed,
right.
But it is destemmed. And cold soak for 5 days, and then it's just little remontage, little pump over, manual. I mean, it's only one big Tarenceau full
right.
of 20 hectoliters, so it's you do manual pump over. And it's basically infusion. You don't have, a lot of extraction. Or
right.
It's very gentle, no sulfur, a little bit at the bottling. But it's on the Raj and Sashi way, you know.
Your style.
Yeah, low intervention.
What about, organic farming, minimal intervention in the cellar. What about aging? What's it aged on? Wood?
It's wood, yes, but
no new oak.
It's actually Pinot Noir. It's Domaine de la Côte barrels.
It's their barrels.
Yeah.
And are those French or American?
Yes, they are French. It's French oak mostly. I think they have Camus from France, if I'm not wrong. And but yes, it's French oak, and it's aged for 22 months, almost 2 years.
All right, let's give it a taste. So we're wrapping the show up. I'm sitting with Marie, I'm sitting with Sarah, and I'm sitting with Katja, and we're all holding a glass. So every week, we taste a different wine on air, and we're tasting the 2017 Colette made by Marie. All right, so let's give it a little sniff and throw it over the tongue and see what we get here. Okay? Let's talk color first. When it came out of the name of the thing already.
The Corvin.
When it came out of the Corvin, it seemed a little more pale, but it's kind of deeper in color. The color, is this a classic Merlot? Is this a little lighter?
It's maybe on the lighter side
okay.
than classic
not
Merlot,
too light.
But not too light. Classic Merlot would tend to be darker, more purple. We do have a lighter red
right.
here.
All right, let's put it under our nose and give it a sniff. What do we get on the nose? Classic Merlot descriptors, a little different. I'm going to go around the table and come to you last.
Okay.
What do you get on this, Katja?
Dark berries, like...
dark berries?
Yeah, cherries, but...
Cherries? Dark cherries?
Yes.
Not the red cherries. Yeah. What about you, Sarah?
Definitely like blackberry. And
black. So that classic
generous,
dark.
Yeah, generous.
Do you
aromatics.
Agree, Marie?
Oh, totally. I love this.
All right.
And I would add a little floral violet knot.
Yes.
Which is really.
Yes, on the violets.
I'm happy to find it today.
Let's taste it and let's talk about the mouthfeel. So I would say it's a medium. What would anyone else say? Is it less than medium? Is it medium plus? What kind of mouthfeel?
Medium. I'm on the medium.
Yeah.
Yes, totally.
Feels nice in the mouth. All right, let's talk palate. Do the nose descriptors translate to the palate descriptors? What do we get on the palate?
I do find the fruit, again, a little bit more spicy due to the oak aging, but very subtle.
Even with the violet, there's a spice factor.
Yes.
There's definitely dark fruits.
I like that we have a little angular structure.
Yes.
Getting to know also further and further the vineyard will improve also, you know, not the style, but the length, the complexity of it. It's beautiful up front, and the middle is also palate. Maybe we'll gain a little bit more length in the future. It's still very young.
Right, it is a very young wine. What would you pair this with? What's a good food pairing? You crack out a couple of bottles. You have a chance to cook for some friends.
Yes. No. We cook a little bit. I already had Colette on pizza. It was amazing. I already had Colette with duck. It was great. So simple. I wouldn't go for too many spices.
Right.
But definitely duck. But also you can do certain fish with that because we are on the delicate side of Merlot. So I work a lot with fish, nice charcuterie if we want to make it easy. This is, I think, because of the acidity, this is a wine easy to pair.
It's funny because my last taste, I picked up three things. The acidity, which I liked for food. there's that positive vegetal quality. Yeah. I wouldn't say like green peppers or whatever, but there's something good about it that's there. And typical where wine is going in Raj, it's restrained, but not, you know, it's got everything a Merlot should have, but made really well. It's a very nice wine.
Thank you.
That's the 2017 Colette. Good luck getting it.
Yes, right? Thanks.
All right, we got to wrap up. Thank you, Marie Poncinet, for joining us on The Grape Nation.
Thank you, Sam.
Let me do a quick wrap up. We'll say goodbye to everybody. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to The Grape Nation on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, on Instagram, or at my site at SBenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. And on Twitter, we're at BenRuby, no S, and the hashtag The Grape Nation. As I said during the show, we'll post Katya, Sarah, and Marie's wine list answers. Those are some fun answers. Good info. And for the weekly wine sip selection, which was Marie's Colette wine, I will post a little more information on that. If we want to follow you guys on social media, where do I follow you, Marie?
Marie Poncinet and Colette Wine.
Okay, P-O-N. No, P-O-N.
No, you're good.
P-O-N. S-O-N-N-E-T.
Perfect.
Poncinet. Right. Sarah, a little different.
E-S-S underscore.
S, which is phonetic for S underscore Thomas. And is there a site for Kalamata's Kitchen?
At Kalamata's Kitchen.
Okay, that's, we spelled it earlier. And Katya?
Katya underscore.
K-A-T-J-A underscore.
And an S-C-H-A-R-N.
Scharnagel without an E. Okay? All right, guys, I want to thank you very much. This was very special for me because you're terrific guys doing terrific things at a terrific place. And it's a lot of fun to, you know, talk about everything. And I wish you all good luck. And hopefully I'll come back here again. But also see you on the outside. And good luck with everything. Thank you to our guests, Katya Scharnagel, Sarah Thomas, and Marie Poncinet. Thank you to our engineer, Jeet, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.